Chapter 7. The Question of Sex. From Field Notes of Ong Tot Opong, Investigator of the First Ecumenical Landing Party on Gethen / Winter, Cycle 93, EY, 1448. 1448, Day 81. It seems likely that they were an experiment. The thought is unpleasant, but now that there is evidence to indicate that the Terran colony was an experiment, the planting of one Hainish normal group on a world with its own proto-hominid autochthonies, the possibility cannot be ignored. Human genetic manipulation was certainly practiced by the colonizers. Nothing else explains the Hilfs of S, or the degenerate winged hominids of Rokanan. Will anything else explain Gathenian sexual physiology? Accident, possibly. Natural selection, hardly. Their ambisexuality has little or no adaptive value. Why pick so harsh a world for an experiment? No answer. Tinnebossel thinks the colony was introduced during a major interglacial. Conditions may have been fairly mild for their first 40 or 50,000 years here. By the time the ice was advancing again, the Hamish withdrawal was complete, and the colonists were on their own, an experiment abandoned. I theorize about the origins of Gathenian sexual physiology. What do I actually know about it? Otya Nim's communication from the Orgorain region has cleared up some of my earlier misconceptions. Let me set down all I know, and after that my theories. First things first. The sexual cycle averages 26 to 28 days. They tend to speak of it as 26 days, approximating it to the lunar cycle. For 21 or 22 days, the individual is somer, sexually inactive, latent. On about the 18th day, hormonal changes are initiated by the pituitary control, and on the 22nd or 23rd day, the individual enters kemer, estrus. In this first phase of kemer, karheidisch secher, he remains completely androgynous. Gender and potency are not attained in isolation. A Gathenian in first phase kemer, if kept alone or with others not in kemer, remains incapable of coitus. Yet the sexual impulse is tremendously strong in this phase, controlling the entire personality, subjecting all other drives to its imperative. When the individual finds a partner in kemer, hormonal secretion is further stimulated, most importantly by touch, secretion, scent, until in one partner either a male or female hormonal dominance is established. The genitals engorge or shrink accordingly, foreplay intensifies, and the partner, triggered by the change, takes on the other sexual role. Without exception? If there are exceptions resulting in kemer partners of the same sex, they are so rare as to be ignored. The second phase of kemer, karheidisch Thorharman, the mutual process of establishing sexuality and potency, apparently occurs within a time span of 2 to 20 hours. If one of the partners is already in full kemer, the phase for the newer partner is liable to be quite short. If the two are entering kemer together, it is likely to take longer. Normal individuals have no predisposition to either sexual role in kemer. They do not know whether they will be the male or the female, and have no choice in the matter. Otyanim wrote that in the Orgorain region, the use of hormone derivatives to establish a preferred sexuality is quite common. I haven't seen this done in rural Karheid. Once the sex is determined, it cannot change during the kemer period. The culminant phase of kemer, Karheidish Thokemer, lasts from 2 to 5 days, during which sexual drive and capacity are at maximum. It ends fairly abruptly, and if conception has not taken place, the individual returns to the somer phase within a few hours. Note, Otya Nim thinks this fourth phase is the equivalent of the menstrual cycle. And the cycle begins anew. If the individual was in the female role and was impregnated, hormonal activity, of course, continues, and for the 8.4-month gestation period and the 6 to 8-month lactation period, this individual remains female. The male sexual organs remain retracted, as they are in somer, the breasts enlarge somewhat and the pelvic girdle widens. With the cessation of lactation, the female re-enters soma and becomes once more a perfect androgyne. No physiological habit is established, and the mother of several children may be the father of several more. Social observations. Very superficial as yet. I have been moving about too much to make coherent social observations. Kemer is not always played by pairs. Pairing seems to be the commonest custom, but in the Kemer houses of towns and cities, groups may form and intercourse take place promiscuously among the males and females of the group. The furthest extreme from this practice is the custom of vowing Kemmering, Karaitish Oskyomer, which is to all intents and purposes monogamous marriage. It has no legal status, but socially and ethically is an ancient and vigorous institution. The whole structure of the Karaitish clan hearths and domains is indubitably based upon the institution of monogamous marriage. I am not sure of divorce rules in general. Here in Asnorenr there is divorce, but no remarriage after either divorce or the partner's death. One can only vow Kemmering once. Descent, of course, is reckoned, all over Gethen, from the mother, the parent in the flesh, Karhadish Amma. Incest is permitted, with various restrictions, between siblings, even the full siblings of a vowed Kemmering pair. Siblings are not, however, allowed to vow Kemmering, nor keep Kemmering after the birth of a child to one of the pair. Incest between generations is strictly forbidden in Karhide Ogorain, but is said to be permitted among the tribesmen of Perunter, the Antarctic continent. This may be slander. What else have I learned for certain? That seems to sum it up. There is one feature of this anomalous arrangement that might have adaptive value. Since coitus takes place only during the period of fertility, the chance of conception is high, as with all mammals that have an estrous cycle. In harsh conditions, where infant mortality is great, a race survival value may be indicated. At present, neither infant mortality nor the birth rate runs high in the civilized areas of Gethen. Tinnebossel estimates a population of not over 100 million on the three continents, and considers it to have been stable for at least a millennium. Ritual and ethical abstention and the use of contraceptive drugs seem to have played the major part in maintaining this stability. There are aspects of ambisexuality that we have only glimpsed or guessed at, and which we may never grasp entirely. The Kemmer phenomenon fascinates all of us investigators, of course. It fascinates us, but it rules the Gethenians, dominates them. The structure of their societies, the management of their industry, agriculture, commerce, the size of their settlements, the subjects of their stories, everything is shaped to fit the Somer-Kemmer cycle. Everybody has his holiday once a month. No one, whatever his position, is obliged or forced to work when in Kemmer. No one is barred from the Kemmer house, however poor or strange. Everything gives way before the recurring torment and festivity of passion. This is easy for us to understand. What is very hard for us to understand is that 4/5 of the time these people are not sexually motivated at all. Room is made for sex, plenty of room, but a room, as it were, apart. The society of Gethen, in its daily functioning and in its continuity, is without sex. Consider, anyone can turn his hand to anything. This sounds very simple, but its psychological effects are incalculable. The fact that everyone between 17 and 35 or so is liable to be, as Nim put it, tied down to childbearing, implies that no one is quite so thoroughly tied down here as women elsewhere are likely to be, psychologically or physically. Burden and privilege are shared out pretty equally. Everybody has the same risk to run or choice to make. Therefore, nobody here is quite so free as a free male anywhere else. Consider, a child has no psychosexual relationship to his mother and father. There is no myth of Oedipus on winter. Consider, there is no unconsenting sex, no rape. As with most mammals other than man, coitus can be performed only by mutual invitation and consent. Otherwise it is not possible. Seduction certainly is possible, but it must have to be awfully well-timed. Consider, there is no division of humanity into strong and weak halves. Protective, protected, dominant, submissive, owner, chattel, active, passive. In fact, the whole tendency to dualism that pervades human thinking may be found to be lessened or changed on Winter. The following must go into my finished directives. When you meet a Gathenian, you cannot and must not do what a bisexual naturally does, which is to cast him in the role of man or woman, while adopting towards him a corresponding role dependent on your expectations of the patterned or possible interactions between persons of the same or the opposite sex. Our entire pattern of sociosexual interaction is non-existent here. They cannot play the game. They do not see one another as men or women. This is almost impossible for our imagination to accept. What is the first question we ask about a newborn baby? Yet you cannot think of a Gathenian as it. They are not neuters, they are potentials or integrals. Lacking the Karhaitish human pronoun used for persons in Sumer, I must say he, for the same reasons as we used the masculine pronoun in referring to a transcendent god. It is less defined, less specific, than the neuter or the feminine. But the very use of the pronoun in my thoughts leads me continually to forget that the Karhaiter I am with is not a man, but a man-woman. The first mobile, if one is sent, must be warned that unless he is very self-assured, or senile, his pride will suffer. A man wants his virility regarded. A woman wants her femininity appreciated, however indirect and subtle the indications of regard and appreciation. On Winter they will not exist. One is respected and judged only as a human being. It is an appalling experience. Back to my theory. Contemplating the motives for such an experiment, if such it was, and trying perhaps to exculpate our heinous ancestors from the guilt of barbarism, of treating lives as things, I have made some guesses as to what they might have been after. The Sumer-Kemmer cycle strikes us as degrading, a return to the estrus cycle of the lower mammals, a subjection of human beings to the mechanical imperative of rut. It is possible that the experimenters wished to see whether human beings lacking continuous sexual potentiality would remain intelligent and capable of culture. On the other hand, the limitation of the sexual drive to a discontinuous time segment and the equalizing of it in androgyny must prevent, to a large extent, both the exploitation and frustration of the drive. There must be sexual frustration, though society provides as well as it can against it. So long as the social unit is large enough that more than one person will be in Kemmer at one time, sexual fulfillment is fairly certain. But at least it cannot build up. It is over when Kemmer is over. Fine, thus they are spared much waste and madness. But what is left in Sumer? What is there to sublimate? What would a society of eunuchs achieve? But of course, they are not eunuchs in Sumer, but rather more comparable to pre-adolescence. Not castrate, but latent. Another guess concerning the hypothetical experiment's object: the elimination of war. Did the ancient Hainish postulate that continuous sexual capacity and organized social aggression, neither of which are attributes of any mammal but man, are cause and effect? Or, like Thomas Song Angot, did they consider war to be a purely masculine displacement activity, a vast rape, and therefore, in their experiment, eliminate the masculinity that rapes and the femininity that is raped? God knows. The fact is that Gathenians, though highly competitive, as proved by the elaborate social channels provided for competition, for prestige, etc., seem not to be very aggressive. At least, they apparently have never yet had what one could call a war. They kill one another readily by ones and twos, seldom by tens or twenties, never by hundreds or thousands. Why? It may turn out to have nothing to do with their androgyne psychology. There are not very many of them, after all. And there is the climate. The weather of winter is so relentless, so near the limit of tolerability, even to them with all their cold adaptations, that perhaps they use up their fighting spirit fighting the cold. The marginal peoples, the races that just get by, are rarely the warriors. And in the end, the dominant factor in Guthenian life is not sex or any other human thing, it is their environment, their cold world. Here man has a crueler enemy, even than himself. I am a woman of peaceful Chippewar, and no expert on the attractions of violence or the nature of war. Someone else will have to think this out. But I really don't see how anyone could put much stock in victory or glory after he had spent a winter on winter and seen the face of the ice.